My name is Gene, and I too am an alcoholic. And as I said last week and any other time that I'm at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I identify myself as an alcoholic, I base that identification on how I interpret the definition of the word alcoholic as it's defined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that book it says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And that's all it says. It doesn't make any reference to how much we drank, what we drank, or where we were when we drank, or any of those hideous things that become part of the life of the practicing alcoholic. It doesn't say that in order to be an alcoholic, we got to drink wine, live on skid row, spend weekends in drunk tanks, marry the same woman four or five times, and do all those other silly things, because they do happen to people who identify themselves as non-alcoholics. Many times, you know, in my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, since 1950, many people ask questions like, what's the most important part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? And there was a time when I used to give an answer to that, you know. But, of course, as I grew up in AA, I come to find out that there is no one single thing that carries any higher degree of importance than the other. To some, it may seem that some things are more important, but Alcoholics Anonymous is just sort of like a car, you know. You need all of the parts of the car in order for it to function. The spark plugs don't look as important as the block, and the distributor cap doesn't seem to be as important as the muffler. But take any one of them parts away, and the car won't run. So you need all of the parts. Now, the reason I used to give an answer to this used to be about sponsorship. And I'll tell you why I was led to believe that sponsorship was the most important part of the program. Years ago, we used to have a green and white pamphlet called Questions and Answers on Sponsorship. It's a different pamphlet nowadays, but on the opening page of that pamphlet, it described sponsorship. And it said something like this. It said, sponsorship is the heart of the AA approach to recovery. Now, when you mention the word heart, you're talking about the most important organ of our body. It's a vital part of our body. Without the heart, you die. And so I innocently enough, and probably understandably, when they said sponsorship is the heart of this program, I believed, well, by God, this must be the most important thing, because obviously if they call it the heart, they're telling me that without it, you die. But then, of course, as I said before, I came to understand different. But sponsorship, of course, is an integral part of our program. Sponsorship is AA. That is exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous is, always was, and always will be. The sharing of an experience is between two alcoholics, one-to-one. And that's exactly what sponsorship is. But there are many confusing aspects of alcoholism. A lot of people think that the person who brings you to your first meeting is your sponsor. Sometimes people think that the guy who's sitting next to you is your sponsor. And people wonder how to select a sponsor, to choose a sponsor. And other people think that the one you choose, you got to keep for the rest of your life. They don't know that you can fire a sponsor once in a while, just as he can fire you. But I think the most, and I'm trying to think of the word, the most damaging thought that many people have about sponsorship is that you're going to become a burden on somebody. You hear people saying, well, I don't want to ask Joe to be my sponsor. Christ, he's got enough to do, you know, and I don't want to bother him with my troubles. Christ, he's an old man. Never forget this, and I speak from experience on this. Sponsorship is a two-edged sword. Many times, many, many, many times, the older member will need the newer member more than the newer member needs the older member. Because it's very easy for so-called old-timers, if you've been bouncing around these rooms for 40 years, pretty soon you forget what puke smells like. You forget the fear of losing a job. You forget the fear of being divorced or the loneliness, that all of the stuff that once held you in terror. And it's the new guy that keeps you fresh on that. It's the new guy that keeps you fresh on that. And we need that. I best could describe sponsorship in a very easy way for me to explain to you. I'm a Scorpio, you know, and Scorpios are water people, you know. We're attracted to the water. And that certainly was true with me, you know. I didn't join the Navy. I joined the Marines like a damn fool, but what the hell, you know. I've never done anything right in my life, you know. But even now, you know, when I drive down from the Napa Valley and go into San Francisco or something, or into Oakland, or go over the Bay Bridge or the Golden Gate Bridge, I'm fascinated by the ships. I still love to see that. And sometimes, you know, in my wildest fantasies, I envision those olden days, you know, of iron men and wooden ships, you know. And I sort of wish the hell I had been there then, you know. Yo-ho-ho and all of that kind of crap, you know. It must have been a fascinating way to live, you know. And so whenever I go over these bridges, I stop many times. As a matter of fact, the biggest warship in the world is anchored in Alameda right now. It's an aircraft carrier called the USS Carl Vinson. It's a nuclear aircraft carrier, biggest warship in the world. And I get fascinated by these. But I'm still fascinated by long ago. Boy, that must have been something, you know, when you stop to think of these guys sailing these ships out in these vast expanses of water with hardly any kind of direction at all. You know, they go out and shoot the stars a little bit with a sextant, and they didn't have signs, you know, it says, next three exits is Honolulu, or turn left to Wake Island, or anything like that, you know. They had to be great men, the masters of these ships, and they still are probably great men. And for an example, I'd like to imagine that perhaps even right now, over in the Philippine Islands, like, let's say a place like Olangapu in the Philippine Islands, they're probably loading a ship whose port of destination will be Oakland Army Base, Oakland, California, USA. That's where that ship has to bring its cargo. Now, due to smart economics, the ideal way is to get that ship as to Oakland as quick and as cheap as you can. Direct course, you know. Sailing and getting there ahead of time if you can. And so a master of a ship is put in charge of this. And I don't really know how what the mileage would be between the Philippines and here. What, any merchant marine men? 9,000, 8,000 miles, I guess. And these guys take these ships out on this vast expanse. And they bring the ship in a matter of days to the United States. And just off of the coast of San Francisco, a very strange thing takes place. Out around the Farallon Islands, the ship throttles down almost to a standstill. And all of a sudden, a launch-like vessel comes out from the bay, comes out from under the bridge, comes up alongside of this huge ocean-going vessel. They drop a gang ladder over the side. Somebody scurries up the ladder and goes immediately to the bridge of the ship. And I imagine shows some kind of identification. And then, the master of the ship, the man who has taken it 7,999 miles, and only has one more mile to go, turns complete control of that ship over to the stranger. Now, why the hell would he do that? If a guy, my God, if a guy is good enough to bring a ship almost 8,000 miles, you think he could bring it in the last mile? And obviously, most of you know who I'm talking about. Every harbor has them, and they call them harbor pilots. And the little launch you come out in is the pilot launch. And the man that goes aboard that ship is a harbor pilot. And what does a harbor pilot know that the captain of that ship doesn't know? He knows the up-to-the-minute conditions of that harbor. He knows everything that has happened in that harbor right up to that very moment. He knows if the tides have shifted, if an underwater hazard has appeared, if there's a fire on the pier, if there's a strike on the dock. He knows everything about that harbor, things that it wouldn't be possible for the captain of the ship to know. And that's why he brings it in for the last mile. And that's exactly what a sponsor is. You know how to get here, but once you get here, you know, you're not too sure what in the hell to do. And you need somebody to show you around, take you through the rough spots, you know, And basically, that's what a sponsor is, you know. He's not a guru. He's not the smartest guy in AA. He's not a financial advisor. He's not running an employment agency, you know. He's just there to guide you based on his experience, because as a practicing member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he or she should know the up-to-the-minute conditions in that community. You know, you can go into any community in the country and you take out the world directory and it lists all the meetings. Half of them haven't been in existence for 10 years. And you look up some of the names in the book to call up for help, guy died 20 years ago. Or he's in a nut house from drinking, you know. So the books really aren't that much of a help. You got to have somebody right close by. Now, how do you get a sponsor? Well, there's all different ways of getting a sponsor. There's no hurry. There's no time limit on a sponsor. You can use the group as your sponsor for a while because you're about to pick out something very important, something that might mean whether you're going to live or die. I'd like to tell you how I got mine, and in telling you this, I'm going to point out how valuable service work is in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're not involved in it. Because hospital and institutional work has saved my life, saved my life. That's where I got my sponsor. I was in an institution, and these jackasses from AA used to come out there every Sunday night to conduct their little meeting, you know. But first, let me tell you about me. I was no different than a lot of self-centered, egotistical jackasses who come into AA in the beginning, full of denial. I knew all the answers, and you were a bunch of assholes as far as I was concerned. And I'm in and out of institutions left and right, you know, and going backwards fast in my life. There was a place called the Elgin State Hospital. Now, I'm talking about a long time ago when they didn't have hospital programs and treatment things and starting here and starting that kind of programs and all of that bullshit, you know. You didn't have too much of a choice in those days. You went to jail to sober up, or you went to the state insane asylum to sober up, because hospitals wouldn't take you and I in those days. There are many people in this room that know of that, you know. Don't think for one minute that, as it is today, it was like that 15 years ago. There was no way in the world you could get an alcoholic into a hospital in one of them wild conditions that we usually grace places with, you know. You know, you're up there on an intensive care unit where guys are on kidney machines and heart machines, and you're running down the corridor with your ass sticking out of you. I want a pizza, you know. And you don't even have the money to pay for it if they get it, you know. Charge it, you know. So guys like me would go to state hospitals. Now, this is in the Chicago area, so I got to tell you truthfully, I never checked into a state hospital to get any help for alcoholism. And I never checked into one because I thought I was mentally ill. I always checked in around February when it was cold outside, and I couldn't get any place to sleep, you know. January and February and March are tough times to get into a state hospital. And I was in the Elgin State Hospital on 32 different occasions, you know. 32 admissions, you know. Oh, not for 28 days and all of that kind of crap. Sometimes twice in one day I got admitted, you know. I'd sign in, you know, dying at 8 o'clock, and then because they wouldn't give me a drink at 9, I'd check out at 11. And then by 6 o'clock, I'd be screwed up again and check back in, and, you know, and it was insane, insane. As a matter of fact, now this is the truth. I was in and out of the Elgin State Hospital so many times, when the employees had their Christmas party, they invited me. I swear to God, that's the truth. That's the truth. They just considered me part of the staff, you know me. And I sort of like that, you know. The book talks about that. It says we seek a lower environment, you know. Oh, don't laugh at me. You did it too, or you will do it. You know, you no longer can cut it out there with the big guys. Can't cut it out there with the big guys. But if you can check in onto one of them mentally ill wards where 80% of them are on 400 milligrams of Thorazine every 4 hours, you look good. You look good. You're the best ping pong player in there. You're the best pinochle player. Some of the girls think they're the best looking girl in the house. You know, it's easy to be the queen of the nut house, you know. Because there is no competition. There is no competition, you know. And there I am. And I had a regular little pattern, you know, every Sunday night, you know, that the AA guys would come out there. And I'd gather all of my little group together, you know, because I was always put in charge, you know. The nurse would say, Duff, you're in charge, you know. I want you to take the ward over to the Reed building to the AA meeting. So that meant about 6 guys who were alcoholics and 74 who were mentally ill. But I made them all go. Because, you see, them jerks from AA would bring out silly things like chocolate chip cookies that their wives made. And they'd put loose cigarettes out on the counter. And I'd tell my guys, grab all the goddamn cookies you can get. Get some of them light. I don't care if you don't smoke. Get the cigarettes anyhow, you know. And that's really why we went. And I hated the guy who was secretary of that group. I don't think I've ever hated anybody in my life like I hated that man. Of course, I come to find out and know why I hated him. I used to call him the Gray Eagle, you know. He wore a blue suit, white shirt, maroon tie. And he had a crew cut, silver hair, and it looked like he'd just come back from Miami Beach, as though he'd been there a month. And I hated that bastard. Because he was everything that I wanted to be. And I wasn't. And he conducted the meetings, you know. And the meeting had a regular format, which was a good format, and it's a good format still in use today. The meeting was about an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes long. The first speaker would be a 10-minute speaker. And he'd be a guy who had just come out of that hospital sometime in the last 90 days. And he'd be telling us, you know, what it was like 90 days. And most of us probably knew him. So you'd listen to him. And then the next guy that would talk would be a guy who'd been out a year. And you might even know him. So you'd sort of listen to him and you'd believe him. And then they'd have a coffee break of 10 minutes. And then they'd bring on the thunder, you know. 9,933 years of sobriety. Man, and he'd get up and tell you about his Cadillacs and running the bank and all of that kind of crap. And nobody'd pay any attention to him. But the most interesting part of the meeting to me was when they had the coffee break. And that would come after the 2 short speakers. And how it worked is we'd sit around any place you wanted for 15 minutes. And there was one couch in there, one stuffed couch. And, of course, being the authority I was, I got the couch. And I used to sit in the couch, you know, putting cookies in my pockets and cigarettes in my pocket. And I never could figure out how to get the Kool-Aid back to the ward, you know that. And right behind me was a table, sort of like that, where I was sitting. And the AA guys, maybe about 6 of them, were standing behind that table drinking their coffee, shooting the bull this one particular night. And they were talking about strange things that have happened in Mother Nature. Things like, one guy said he had seen a tree in the foliage up in Maine had grown into the exact duplicate of the old Indian head nickel. And somebody else said that down in Sedona, Arizona, that there's a rock formation that's the identical of the Westminster Cathedral or something like that. You know, they're talking about all these Robert Ripley, believe it or not, things, you know. And I wasn't paying a hell of a lot of attention to that, you know. And then all of a sudden the Gray Eagle opened up his mouth with his blue suit and white shirt. And I'm sort of listening. He says, well, you guys ain't going to believe this. So I sort of listen, what are you going to say? You know, what kind of bullshit does he know, you know? And he says, because this almost sounds impossible. And I got a little interested in that. He says, I saw a sewer tile cracked into a perfect figure 8. Boy, and my head went up like a rooster early in the morning in the hen house. Now, I have to explain that to you. Especially out here in California. I'm talking about sewer tile that you put in the streets, 42 inches across in diameter. Now, in California, they make it out of concrete. But in the Middle West, because of the abundance of clay, it's made out of clay and it's baked in kilns, and they call it vitreous clay. It's glazed, and so when it's done, it's as brittle as glass. Now, to strike it with a hammer, and instead of breaking, just go like that. It's impossible. It's impossible as me tapping that window right there, and instead of it breaking, it just cracked in a figure 8. Nobody would believe that. And nobody believed him. But I knew he was telling the truth. I knew it. because I had seen that same track. And I could hardly wait. Now, this guy was the vice president of the locomotive division of General Motors, Bob Lambrecht. I waited for him out in the parking lot, boy, after that meeting, you know. I had to see him, because I was furious, you know. And here he come with his little cardboard box with the literature in it and the gavel and a couple of AA crappy things, you know. And he saw me standing there, and he knew me, and he was always nice to me, had always been nice to me. And I had been in and out of that hospital for 6 years, you know. And he said, "Hi, Duff, what's up?" And I said, "What's up my ass? I said, I want to ask you something." I said, "Who told you about the crack?" And boy, he just looked at me with that look that them old-timers put on their face when they know they got you, you know. And he says, "Why, do you know about the crack?" And I said, "Yeah, I've seen that crack, but you didn't see it where I saw it." And then he said a word that changed my life, He said, "Rothschilds." Now, that won't mean anything to any of you in here. Rothschilds is the name of a saloon on West Madison Street, Chicago, Illinois. It's a scumbag of a place. It's the filthiest, rottenest, scummiest place I've ever been in my life. And that was sort of my headquarters. That was the headquarters for a lot of guys like me. And what was supposed to be a men's room in Rothschilds was out the back door. And the backyard was all fenced in with some old corrugated sheets of steel that they had found someplace. Old rusty old stuff, and they had just stuck it up end on end and just enclosed the whole yard. And then down at the far end of the yard, they had dug by hand a trough the whole length of the backyard. And the trough would lead out underneath the corrugated steel to wherever the hell it went, I don't know. Now, at some time or another, they must have been putting in a sewer system on Madison Street or someplace. And these guys went and stole four of these sewer tiles. And they brought them into the backyard of Rothschilds, and they split them right down the middle, top to bottom, like you would a 55-gallon drum, the long way. And then they turned them up against the wall to simulate urinals. And that was the men's room in Rothschilds. Now, somewhere along the line, the health department got in the act. And he probably got paid off with a bottle of gin or something. But they had to put in some little disinfectant blocks. And they had to put them into the urinals in little wire cages. And so each urinal had a wire cage in it about a foot above the trough. And that was the sanitary system of Rothschilds. Now what I'm about to tell you, I don't know if it's true or not. It's only what I can imagine, Now, on Skid Row in Chicago in those days, I really don't know what it's like now. Many of you are familiar with these things. There's the best thing going for you on Skid Row if you're an alcoholic is day labor. And day labor means you're going to get paid that night. And that's important. And so they used to come in school buses, you know. The Del Monte people were always coming down there to get people to detassel corn or work on the pea vines. And they would even, some of them would give you a tent, them little tenth of bottles, you know, of wine just to get on the bus and go on out and work. But the best job there was the worst job. But you got paid 8 hours for 4 hours work. And that's what they used to call working the slag. Now, working the slag, all around Chicago are steel mills, you know, especially in the Indiana area in South Chicago. And the slag is the clinkers, the unburnt coal, you know, that comes out of the furnaces. And it comes out just like you would fill a silo out here on a farm with a big gooseneck, you know. And somebody has to be on the top of that pile to keep it from backing up into the gooseneck. And it takes about four guys to do this. And these are big gooseneck, big wide things. And these things come flying out of there. And you're up there with a number 9 scoop shovel, and it's your job to keep them going. These things come out red hot, you know. And so you have a helmet on, and they put a little thing over your face, and then you got gloves on, and... But the big thing you got is safety shoes, because you can't work in the steel mills unless you got safety shoes. And safety shoes are them shoes that have the steel tips in them, steel toes, you know. On the market in those days, they probably cost $125. I imagine today they'd be $250, you know. Well, some wise guy working for the steel mills got a brilliant idea one day. Because whenever they would hire you as day labor, you have to go out to the steel mill, you'd go to the personnel office, then you'd have to go in and get shoes, and then have to measure your feet and all of that. You'd use up about 45 minutes to an hour just getting the shoes on. So some efficiency experts said, hey, we got a better idea. Let's donate these shoes to all the charities on Skid Row so that they can give these guys shoes free. Every guy on Skid Row is walking around with $125 shoes on. Steel-tipped shoes. But you see, the advantage in that is that's how they'd hire you in the morning. They'd look down to see if you had them shoes, you know. Get on the bus. Get on the bus. Because they could put you right to work. Well, I always used to take the slag piles like all the alcoholics did, you know. It was very attractive to get paid 8 hours for 4 hours work, even though you're getting hit on the head and getting burnt all over your shoulders. But what the hell? And so that's how it was. And that had been, you know, all I could do for a living, you know. It's the only way I survived down on that street. So when Bob, and I've almost lost my track here, what I was talking about, when Bob was willing, you know, to help me in about, he's talking about Rothschilds, I think that one day somebody had been in Rothschilds, alcoholic or drunk, mad. And you know how we are? Public restrooms seem to be great places for people to vent their rage. I don't know about ladies' rooms. I don't hang out in ladies' rooms. But it's not uncommon to go into a room in a public building or something and find holes punched in the walls where guys have just got mad and just bang, you know. And I imagine some guy must have went out there one day and wanted to punch something. And he looked around, all he could see was that corrugated steel, and he said, well, that ain't so smart, you know. And there was no towel racks to pull off the wall, no mirrors to smash, and he was looking for something. And then all of a sudden he spotted that little wire cage down there with that disinfectant block. And he figured, that's it. And he took that foot back to give it one hell of a shot, and he missed. And his foot went right underneath that cage, and it hit that tile, and whang, 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 whang. You couldn't draw a figure eight better than he cracked a figure eight. And it was there. Now, the guy that was telling me this, I just told you, was the vice president of General Motors Locomotive Division in LaGrange, Illinois. Now, let me refresh you of something. Here's the urinal. The trough is down here that the urine and whatever passes through. The wire cage is a foot above the trough. And the crack is between the bottom of the cage and the top of the trough. I'm not proud of this and I'm not ashamed of it. There's only one position you can be in order to see that crack. Your face had to be in the trough. And I was looking right at a guy standing there in front of me with a white shirt and a maroon tie and a blue suit. And he had been there too. I think that was the first time Alcoholics Anonymous began to make sense to me. Because that took away from me any possible excuse I had ever had in the past. I was looking at a guy who looked good, who had been where I was. And I couldn't deny it. So I knew this program worked. I was reminded of it that night. Because I was sort of stunned, you know, and I left him sort of angrily, you know, because I still harbored an idea that somebody had told him about that, you know. Hell, it's impossible for the vice president of General Motors to be in Rothschilds. Or it's impossible for a guy from Rothschilds to wind up as the vice president of General Motors. I just couldn't believe those things. But I was marching my little gang back to the unit that night. And as I said, about 74 of them were mentally ill. They didn't know where the hell they were or what the hell the meeting was all about anyhow. But in the back, the alcoholics would always walk at the back of the pack. I'm up in the front, you know, leading them all. And I'm ranting and raving and I'm telling all these mentally ill guys what a sicko that Bob is, that guy from AA. Don't believe none of that bullshit he's putting out, you know. I says, I'll give you some inside dope. And, of course, I'm lying now. The biggest defense in the world for practicing alcoholics is to lie, because I have to justify my own inadequacies. And I'm telling these guys, you know what the real dope is? The reason these guys come way out here to the meetings, because they're not allowed to go to meetings in Chicago. They drink during the week. They drink during the week. I says, even that gray-haired guy, I says, how he was up in the DT ward here just a week ago, you know. And, of course, the mentally ill guys, you know, they just trust me. You know, they're going. And I'm not making fun of them. I'm just saying how it was, you know. And then this one particular night, as I'm right in the middle of this tirade, one of the alkies from the back hollers out, hey, Duff, why don't you smarten up? You've been bullshitting about Bob for years. And he's been coming out here every Sunday night sober. You're a liar. And Jesus Christ, humiliated. Now they knew. Even my own guys knew, you know. So I think that was the time then that I began to maybe give this some thought, you know. Maybe the first introduction to humility in this program. At least willing to think of the possibility of asking somebody for some help. And so I thought it over, and, you know, I was sitting in the cell, so I really wasn't doing too good, you know. And so the next Sunday night, I went back there, and I listened to the goddamn meeting and all that crap. And after the meeting, I went out to the parking lot, and I waited for Bob, and here he come. And I walked up to him, I says, Bob, I says, I believe you was in Rothschild's. And he sort of smiled. He says, I've got no reason to lie to you, Duff. And then I said it, you know, words that I thought I'd never say in my life. I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? And I waited for the big hug, you know. And he said, no. God, I wanted to kill him. I wanted to kill him. I was embarrassed. I was humiliated. I was confused. You know, what the hell do you mean, no? I've been listening to you for 6 goddamn years. And now you tell me no. Well, before I could vent my fury on him, he said, hold it. He said, the reason I said no, Duff, is I want you to think it over for a week. And he said, to help you think it over, I'm going to tell you right now what it's going to be like if I'm your sponsor. And I stood there with that cocky attitude we have, you know. Come on, I can handle anything you bunch of wimps got, you know. And he says, Duff, if I'm your sponsor, I'm going to make every decision in your life for the next year without any comment or question from you. Well, I used the F word right there, you know. And I stormed away from him. Then I spent the worst week of my life. You see, I knew he was right and I knew I was wrong. And I spent the whole week trying to switch it. And it just didn't work. It just didn't work. But by the end of the week, I changed my mind about 25 times. And then the next Sunday night, I made up my mind, I don't need you. You know, cocky. I give you a chance to grab a prize, and you say no? What do you? I'll show you. And I got all of that anger up into me like I talked about here the other day. I guess it was here or someplace I talked about. Thought of all them rotten, filthy words I could think of, you know, and tell you what the hell you can do with AA and everything, and I waited for him out in that parking lot, and he came out, and I said, hey, would you be my sponsor? That isn't what I meant to say. I don't know who said that. I don't. I'm convinced that a power greater than myself must have said that. Because why would I say, would you be my sponsor? I didn't want any help. I didn't like that guy. I didn't want a sponsor. Even if I had wanted a sponsor, I wouldn't have asked him. So who said, would you be my sponsor? And then he laid it out to me. He laid it out to me. I'll never forget that. We sat there in his little old station wagon. We sat there till 4 o'clock in the morning in the parking lot of a nut house. And he never asked me anything about me. All he did was talk about him.
And I'm thinking, what the hell is this? I'm the guy with all the problems, you know. So about 4 o'clock, he says, I'll pick you up tonight at 5 o'clock out by the main gate. He said, have all your belongings with you. And I said, what do you mean, 5? I said, I'm signed up, you know, for 3 months here. He said, your record shows you ran away from this place on 17 occasions, so you run away again tonight, you know. They don't, because that was a voluntary commitment, so they don't even look for you when you run away. So at 5 o'clock, I'm standing out there with my California luggage, you know, my Safeway bag, you know. And here he comes in his station wagon, I hop in. Now here I am, right? I got a lot of problems. I got no money, no job, no place to eat, no place to sleep. I got nothing. And where do you think this guy takes me? With all these problems, he takes me to an AA meeting. And I'm sitting in there for an hour and a half, and when the hell are they going to start working on my problems, you know? But of course, I know now, as you know now, AA works differently. They had prepared for me all that day, all that day. So when the meeting was over, he came over to me and says, come on, I want you to meet Hazel. Well, that sounded all right. Went over to meet Hazel. Hazel was a rather attractive lady, well-to-do, you can see that. He said, you're going to be living in Hazel's basement for the next 60 days. Well, that ain't so bad. And she says, Hazel's husband is an attorney. And I go, oh. I wish I could say Hazel's basement was a coal bin. It wasn't. You know, I'd like to make my story sound dramatic, but it wasn't. They were very, very well-to-do people. And what they called a basement was actually a recreation room in their basement. And when Hazel handed me some linen and blanket to take down into the basement where I was to sleep, she says, there's a couch down there and it opens up into a bed. That's where you're going to sleep. And I went down there and I'm opening it up, and I opened it up and I'm looking at a fully stocked bar right in front of me. So I thought I'd be cute, you know. I says, Hazel, you trust me down here with all that booze? She says, that's your problem. She says, touch it and you're out. And I figured, oh, man, I got myself a pit bull here. And it was. I wish time would permit for me to tell you everything that happened, but boy, for the next 57 days. They put the word out on me. Every night that somebody would knock on the door, Hazel would answer. They say, is a guy by the name of Duffy staying here? Oh, yeah. Bob Lambrick sent me over, told me to pick him up and take him to a meeting in Woodstock. Next night it'd be Harvard. Next night it'd be Glen Ellen. Next night it'd be DuPage. Saturday it'd be 3 times during Saturday. I never had any time for myself. And during the day, I had to work. I had to do odd jobs, and the word was out, no money. I mowed lawns. I trimmed hedges. I walked dogs. I was a babysitter. I washed dishes. I'd done the goddamnedest things in the world, but all I got for it was Minin skin bracer, 2 bars of soap, a T-shirt, and some crap like that. Nobody gave me no money, you know. And I could have killed Bob. And so one night he was at a meeting on this is about the 56th day. I told him, I said, come on, Bob. I said, I feel great now. And I said, I'm ashamed of the kind of work I'm doing. And mind you, and I'm not trying to impress you, I was a construction superintendent at that time, building high-rises, you know, in the city. And now I'm out there walking dogs, you know. So I says, it's time for me, I says, to go to work, Bob. I says, I just have to go to work. And he knew that. And he said, yeah, he says, I guess you're right. He says, and I says, okay, I'll go tomorrow and start looking for a job. He says, oh, no, you don't have to do that. I says, what do you mean? He says, I already got your job. I said, oh, yeah? I said, where? He said, well, every day he's on my way into work, he said, I pass the place and they're building a big shopping center there. And he says, there's a sign out in front that says, bricklayers wanted. And I sort of laughed. And, hell, Bob, I ain't a bricklayer no more. I said, I'm a superintendent. I'm a boss. He says, no more you're a boss. He says, you go lay bricks. I didn't realize what he was doing to me there. See, he was taking pressure off of me. If I had gone right back into the cauldron again and took all of the responsibilities and supervision on me, I would have went out and got drunk. I could lay brick with my eyes closed, so it was very easy, and I felt good about myself. I felt a feeling of accomplishment every day. And then he moved me into a boarding house. but a whole bunch of other construction workers, and they weren't all on AA. And I stayed in there for 2.5 months, you know, and it was just men, you know, and every night meetings, you know. And I had an agreement I had with him is I had to deposit my paycheck. I could not cash my paycheck. I had to deposit it in a bank. The only way I could write a check is he had to have his signature on the check, too. And that was it, you know. And I never argued with him, never argued with him over anything, whatever he told me. One night I was going to go to, I used to race harness horses, you know, and I wasn't all that great, but I wasn't all that bad. And I had won an invitational race at a place called Maywood Park the year before. And I hadn't shown up for the award because I was drunk, you know. Now I'm sober, and I got a letter from the Illinois Harness Racing Association to come on in, that they were going to have another night, and they wanted to present me with my award because they thought I had been sick in the veterans hospital, you know. And so I called up Bob one night, and I says, "Hey, Bob," I says, "I won't be able to go to a meeting Thursday night." Mr. Tuggy, kind of guy he was. And he went, "Why?" I said, "I got to go to Maywood Park," I says, "to pick up a prize from when I was racing horses." He says, "Oh?" He says, "The next time you get drunk, call up a horse." And he hung up. See, I knew what he meant. He was telling me not to get my priorities mixed up. And so I did that, you know, I did that. And I began to do all of these things. And then one day I said to him, "Bob," I says, "it's no good in that boarding house." I says, "Christ almighty." I says, "I'm the last one home. Our job's the furthest away. And there's no showers, just two big bathtubs. And the guy's never cleaned it up. And it's always dirty." And so he sort of understood, you know. And he says, "Yeah," he says, "I guess we could get you your own place now." I said, "Okay." Now, when you tell an alcoholic you can think about getting his own place, to him that means go ahead and find one right away. Now, I don't know how many of you know where Elgin, Illinois is. That's right next to O'Hare Field in Chicago. 85% of the airline stewardesses are trained in O'Hare Field. Women outnumber men in Elgin, Illinois, 90-1. Even fat, bald-headed guys like me score in Elgin, Illinois. I went to rent an apartment in a complex for singles only. That didn't last too long. He wouldn't go for that. He wouldn't sign the check. And he moved me into an old house that I had to remodel. And I need an extra 5 minutes to tell you this because it's important. This thing changed my life, and it changed the lives of a lot of other people, and it authenticated a verse in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It saved my life. When I said I was moving into this place called the Carteret Arms, he said, "No way. He said, you'll be drunk in a week in there." And he was probably right. All I saw was little girls walking by with bikinis on, a bottle of wine, a loaf of bread, you know. Ah, the wilderness, boy. Blue light bulbs, travel posters, and incense all over the place, you know. I would have went crazy in there. So he says, "No," he says, "I got a place for you." He says, "A real estate friend of mine has an old house." He says, "They don't want to sell it yet because they're going to use it for future development. But kids are getting in there and they're raising hell with it. They've just torn it all to hell." He said, "You can live in there free. They'll furnish the coal for you to keep the place warm. But while you're there, fix up a few of the things around there. It won't cost you nothing for rent." Well, the house looked like that house in the Munster movie, you know. It was horrible. First night I was there, two of the guys bought a mattress and some linen. That was my bed. I went to take a shower. I take a shower every night of my life. You know, I went in this, what was supposed to be a bathroom, to take a shower. And it was filthy. Gee, there were big roaches in there and stains all over. And I scrubbed, and I scrubbed, trying to get it clean, you know. And I couldn't do nothing with it, so I just took a little GI bath that night. But the next day, on the way back from work, I stopped off one of them cheap hardware stores, and I bought a couple of gallons of paint for, you know, $1.99 a gallon. And I painted the bathroom so it would be clean. The next night, I painted the kitchen. And then somebody bought me a couple of pieces of furniture to put in the living room. Wednesday, somebody bought me an old bed. Then I went to an auction the following Saturday at some farm. And I bought a dining room set for $40 that it was probably worth $10,000, 16 pieces, you know. Beautiful piece of thing. In short, in about 6 months, I furnished that whole house. I had 7 bedrooms in that. And I furnished it all in early goodwill, you know. Paper drapes and all that, but it was clean and it looked good. And things started to happen. There was always guys there. Always guys coming by in the morning, Saturday, have a cup of coffee with me, shoot the bull, and the two more guys would come by and shoot the bull. Then one Thursday night, we're down at Joliet Penitentiary. You know, my sponsor was doing the H&I down there. And one of the convicts, a black fellow by the name of Cleo, gets up and says, I'm getting discharged tomorrow. And he says, I don't really have any place to go. And boom, Jesus, my sponsor gave me a shot in the ribs. Did you hear what Cleo said? And so I went up and I said, Cleo, I'll pick you up tomorrow. I said, I'll come down here and get you. I'll take a half a day off from work and you can come and stay with me. I said, until you get a job. I wish I could say this story turned out fine, that Cleo came home and stayed with me, grew up to be the GSR for the whole state of Illinois and spoke at the last international convention. It didn't. He was gone the next morning with my typewriter, a radio, and a few other things, you know. But that's all right. That's all right. And then the next night somebody said, hey, there's a guy getting out of jail tomorrow, but his wife can't pick him up till Tuesday. Can he stay at your house till Tuesday? Then a couple of days later, one of the AA guys said, hey, Duff, here's $50. You know, buy some of the groceries for the guys, you know. And somebody else would drop a 20 down. And then three guys would come out of the state hospital. And I never realized what the hell was going on. Never realized what was going on. I'm the only guy working in this goddamn place, you know. These other guys are all staying home there, you know, and hanging around all day. And AAs are in and out of there forever. And then I fell in love with a little chick, you know. And boy, I had great ideas, you know, for weekends, you know. But these goddamn AA guys was there all weekend, you know. So I'm blowing off to them one night. I'm sick and tired of you assholes hanging out here. For Christ's sake, I never got any privacy. And I said, you got all of these jerks living in here. I said, I don't even know their names, half of them. And I says, they come in here drunk. They got out of here drunk. And I says, for Christ's sake, nobody in this goddamn house stay sober. And boy, you should have heard the quiet come over. And I said, what the hell is your quiet for? And then somebody said it. They said, You did. And then I remembered what Dr. Bob says in his book. Nothing will ensure your sobriety more than working with others. It was that day that I decided that if I ever had the opportunity, I'd open up a treatment facility for alcoholics with God's help and God's guidance. And it's exactly what has happened to me for the last 26 years in the Napa Valley. It all started at 74 Crystal Street in Elgin, Illinois, you know. I thought a bunch of assholes, you know, were interfering with my life. They were giving me my life, and I didn't know that. Just like every Thursday night when I go to San Quentin, or used to go to San Quentin, I got mad there one night. I thought, what the hell is Ascension coming over here? These guys walk around during the meetings. They bang their cups. They giggle. They laugh. They talk. Not one of these son of a bitches stayed sober. Somebody said, yeah, but you did. You did. See, I used to think that we were people who went out to sober up people. I forgot what it says. It says we carry a message. We're not capable of sobering up anybody. That job is done up there. We have to work with these people to keep me sober. Me sober. And you have to do that to keep you sober. And if sponsorship isn't the most important part, it's truly then the heart. It's the heart. From this experience, and it's one of the musts in the book, you know, people in here know how I get a little bit fanatical sometimes. Polly knows very well. You know, I'm a bullshitter probably in every area of my life. I cheat at cards, and I chase redheads. I'm single, you know. But the one area where I don't fool around is right here, you know. This is my life. And sometimes I become an AA cop, you know. I try to defend AA, you know. I'm scared somebody's going to hurt it. And you hear people running around saying stupid things. And one of the most stupid things you hear in AA nowadays, and I'll probably get in trouble because maybe one of you has just said it, you know. There are no musts in AA. How many times have you heard that? And I'll sit here with you to midnight if you want to. I'll show you 57 times in this book where it says must, M-U-S-T. It doesn't say you had better or if you choose or when you're ready. It says must. And one of the musts is what I've been talking about. It says, watching a fellowship grow up around you is an experience you must not miss. That's what AA is. Do you really realize what guys like Eddie and Bob did for me or you do for other people by one simple little verse? Allow me to tell you. You know, not far from here in San Francisco, at the University of California Hospital in San Francisco, at Stanford University, they transplant hearts. Jesus Christ, that's a fantastic thing. Give somebody a heart. Whenever they do that, they banner that news all over the world. And then down in UCLA, they transport kidneys and livers. They take them out of people who are deceased and they give them to somebody so they can live. In the Michael Reese Hospital in Chicago, Illinois, is the Federal Eye Bank. They store eyes there. Eyes that with some people they can give to somebody who's blind so that they can see. Those are miraculous things. I have no argument with that. And they're done by very learned people. But what about me and you? We do a very simple little thing, and you've all done it, or it's been done to you. The guy that said it to me was Eddie Friel. He said, "Hey, Boomer." He said, "I'm an alcoholic." And he says, "I belong to AA. Would you like to go to a meeting?" Do you realize what that was? He wasn't giving me just my heart, my kidneys, or my liver, my eyes. He's giving me the whole ball of wax. Here is your life. And that's what you and I can do. We can do what the greatest of physicians could never have done before. The most learned of our scholars couldn't do this. The greatest theologians in the world couldn't do it. But you and I, the so-called outcasts of the world, by a simple little verse, "Would you like to go to a meeting?" We give people their life. Thank you very much.